When Adrian and I planned this season of readings, I wasn't aware how much tonight's two poets had in common. In her new book, Seeds Across Snow, Kathleen Driscoll also details loss and the lessons we learn from it. The loss of her neighbor and the lovely and lyrical overture to the book, which is really the title poem in disguise. The loss of nature in our lives. The loss of the family dog. Loss of virginity. And the loss of language and memory in the poem Keeping Words, which is funny and moving, and which would be a loss to us if she didn't read it tonight. My favorite poem in the book may be Nude Model, which describes the loss of youth and beauty in wise and delicate couplets. But Kathleen's poems aren't all elegies. As Molly Peacock, no stranger to this podium, informs us, quote, Driscoll makes a poetry of emergencies, alternating with a deep appreciation of those moments in life when all is well. I think Molly Peacock must especially be referring to the marriage poems in this book, which they also have in common, by the way, tonight's two poets, of which poet Claudia Emerson, author of the Pulitzer-winning poetry book Late Wife, so she should know, says, quote, her poems about love in the context of a long marriage, something all too rarely experienced and even more rarely expressed, are finely wrought and particularly beautiful. In addition to Seed Across Snow, published this year by Red Hen Press, Kathleen Driscoll is the author of Laughing Sickness, which was published by Fleur-de-Lis Press in 1999, and, by the way, is funny as sin. She won an Al Smith Fellowship from the Kentucky Arts Council and grants from the Kentucky Foundation for Women. Her work has appeared in North American Review, Southern Review, the Greensboro Review, and, of course, River Styx. She serves as the Associate Program Director of, I have to take a deep breath for this, Spalding University's Brief Residency Master of Fine Arts in Writing Program in Louisville, Kentucky. And she lives with her husband and two children in an old country church built before the American Civil War. Please welcome a fine poet and loyal pal, Kathleen Driscoll.
Oh, hi everyone. Richard's so tall. Is that better? Okay? All right. Thank you, Richard. I've been taking my book around a little bit, and I was most recently introduced as a poet who writes about her family and her home. I was like, wow, way to clear a room. That was so I was very defensive. I felt like I had to get up, and I jumped to the podium. I go, yeah, but my family's really whacked, and my house is haunted. Okay, so that's really what's in this book. I'm going to read a little bit about the whacked part of the family first, okay? This is called To the Outdoor Wedding. All come, forgive, and bless the dogmatic, overripe bride who insists she will be married in the garden of her dead mother, though the guests and wedding party hiss and shiver as the light rain turns unrepentantly to pelting ice. All rise and love the narrow bridesmaids, numb and underdressed in lavender slivers of spaghetti strap, and listen to their teeth chatter as they scurry down the aisle, drawn to the collective body heat of the groomsman and minister, shifting from foot to foot under the wavering trellis of altar. Praise the wind picking up mightily, and the groom, unsteady and sallow, who does not beam when she appears in blown splendor on her father's arm. And the guests who are wet-faced, their heads bowed down to keep the sleet from stinging. It is the bride, prayerful and confident in her white faith, we have to thank when a gust picks up and wraps her long veil three times around her father's head, shrouding him from the booming garden tent about to unpluck itself from the soggy ground. Who else but her to be thankful to when instead of the tent, her veil snaps free from the father's flailing and lifts high, then thrashes away over the Kentucky cornfields, just now brilliant in their new spring greening, the green shine, the sumptuous periwinkle sky, the brilliant white strata folding into itself and dropping its knot. But wait, again, the wind sends it sailing, and the guests, heads up now, mouths open in collected prayer of ah and ah, as the veil transforms into a bucking Chinese dragon, taking away all that is old, folding, dancing off and far. The guests gather themselves and offer the warm utterance, ooh, when from the thawing and newly planted fields, 1,000 black starlings lift in alarm. Just say hi to my student Barbara out there. One of the things about being in a low residency MFA writing program is that you can have students all over the country. And in fact, Richard is an alum. Came in more as a colleague than a student, I have to say. And we were lucky enough to have Richard in Louisville last week or 2 weeks ago. I'm kind of losing track. And he had a wonderfully packed and appreciative audience, so it was great to see him there. I'm going to read a poem that was published in River Styx, actually. This is called "With a Shiner, My Husband Enters the Flower Shop." I should be thinking of him and how he could have lost an eye when the malignant scaffolding collapsed and a 2x4 dropped through the air on the job site the morning of our 19th anniversary. But I'm considering her, the florist, looking up from her table to see him walking in, sheepish, head bowed, ringing the bell as he enters. I'm wondering how many times she's arranged roses for the wounded, the bruised, the stitched, hungry male who needs her help and fast. And I wonder if she imagines me, black cast iron skillet, cocked in hand like a baseball bat, as she pulls out the 3 stems of delphinium, blue as a bruised heart, and 2 full hydrangea, pink-petaled and soft as boxed lingerie. There is not baby's breath, I'm relieved to see, nor the red lips of soft roses, nor the ubiquitous and overly cheerful mum. She knows somehow what he does not, preoccupied with his day-to-day, that even a good long marriage holds small hurts that barb and fester near the skin. So she reaches for the balm of calm sweep of palm leaf, that healer of the unsaid argument of morning, the rising blood as I watched him back out in his truck, his having forgotten once again, this morning of all mornings, to hang up his towel, curled like a wet dog asleep on the bathroom floor. A long marriage remembers its youth as a roan muscled horse, rearing with nostrils flared. I accept this bouquet for what I could have said, but didn't, and hold on to the thin healing. I accept, too, finally, that often a long marriage is a donkey schlepping across the desert. Tender-eyed, I attempt to once again re-love husband as self, to heal the wounded eye as one tries to heal self, and accept the vase on the table, which stands to remind each day as I change its water, that even this good marriage is from time to time a sorry animal in need and overburdened, but grateful for the hard day it closes sore eyes against. Okay, I've had a request, if I can find it. Let me see. That's one of the nicest poems I've written for my husband. I know you were saying, I usually write about him. I was like, I've written a really great poem for you. And when he's been in the audience, he's like, I don't think I come out so well in that poem. I'm like, but you got to admit, it's a lot better than the other times when I kill you off, you know, with a... So anyway, okay, excuse me here. Keeping words for Richard. It stopped their bickering cold in the back seat when I turned fingertips on temples and screamed, "My God, you've got to stop. You're giving me a splitting hairbrush." We laughed all the way through Georgia. But a few months later, during spring cleaning, my husband stood in the dark mouth of the attic and stared below in disbelief. "What?" I asked sharply. "Just hand down the damned birdcage and let's get on with it." "The birdcage," I bellowed and stamped at his lack of comprehension. Then gently he dropped into my hands the scalloped and pink two-storied iced like a birthday cake Barbie dollhouse. "Thanks," I huffed. "Sheesh. My doctor says it's nothing, that like a lot of women my age, I do not sleep enough to find the right words, that I should accept a birdcage as a dollhouse, take solace in the fact I know she's not a plumber. And I do, and I realize, too, that the stainless steel halo screwed to my neighbor's head is not a halo, nor is an astronaut's helmet keeping her safe for her next airless journey, nor is she placed here merely to prove someone's worse off than me. And ketchup is not blood, though it is sweet and rich, and the key is not a pencil, though they both waggle in crooked places, and the small green pond at the front door does not hold fan-tailed koi, but cheap goldfish who are not in a womb. And my newly teenaged son was not, cannot, will not, but is actually magnificent. And my daughter did have a dollhouse beat up and crayon stained and dragged to the curb where it slumped for 3 days, not like the birdcage, not the sort anyway that I want to keep her in. That cage would be painted purple and have a safe trapeze. And my body is not a temple, but asylum. Though my home is a church, and when I wake in the morning and look into the face of my husband, he is my lover, for who could not be mad about a man who resignedly handed down a dollhouse when his wife demanded a birdcage? When I look at him, I remind myself to make labels, stick them in my favorite books, in a jar of precious saffron threads, on the watercolor of Matisse's view over Nîmes, a clean and tidy attic, all those and other gifts he's given me. Those labels will all read, "Husband, husband." In this book, when my husband and I bought an old country church, that was not very romantic looking, I have to say, so don't imagine stained glass windows and charm. It actually had orange indoor-outdoor shag carpeting, and that dark paneling that we all had in our 70s basements was like all over everything. And we moved back from graduate school, and somehow we wandered upon it, and he said, "Let's pull over," and I said, "For God's sake, why?" And my son was a toddler then, and I was bouncing him on my hip, and Terry, my husband, said, he's a builder, he's in the construction, he's actually a master carpenter, and he crawled underneath it, and he came out, and he sort of wiped off the red dust, and he said, "We're getting it." And I said, "No, we're not." But we did get it. And when we moved in, we didn't realize that we had moved into a place that was part of the haunted lore of our community. And actually, it had been empty for a while, and kids drank beer in it, and teenage kids tried to get in our house for years to drink beer. We'd see the doorknob wiggle and stuff. I'm like, "You go this time." But I have to say, there have been some really terrible things that have happened around our house. And so the book is kind of built around some of those things. And so I'll read some of those poems as well. Blue Canoe. Today, God was the red-chinned buzzard that caught the boy's attention and moved their eyes to the side of the barn where the sun illuminated the blue canoe. And God was the idea that became a tug on the sleeve of the t-shirt and the words, "Come on." And God was the path through the field and the rain that began to fall as the boys pulled the canoe through, parting the tall gold grass, leaving the appalling trail behind them. And God made the rain come down harder around them, pocking Floyd's fork into swelling. And God was the laughter and the loud language and the gleeful paddling through the current that went wilder, but also the tree that snatched the canoe and flipped it, trapping the boys underneath. And God was the air that rested inside the hole and the 911 call to the sheriff made by the passerby and the voice of the sheriff as he radioed. And God was in the ring of the phone call that one father picked up. And God was the hand of the other steering through rush hour traffic and in the tall shadows of men who waited on the bank. And God was there too, giving hope until the canoe could be recovered, uncovering the last breaths. And then he was not. This is a poem about the farm next door, the haunted farm next door, next to the haunted cemetery that I look out on in the haunted house that I live in, the church. Hilltop Farm. The fields of the farm next door are all wrong. In the winter, they are brittle and icy with your loss. In the spring, the rivulets from hard rain try to wash the old blood in the path left when you struggled up the hill. The expressway below where you were dumped and rolled into a ravine and left for dead becomes a place to stop, not to go on. And the cows in the field, once proud Black Angus, seem to understand that they too are on their way to market. They learned it that night when under the hard black sky you crawled by, pulling yourself up one handful of grass after another and under the fence and into the fields where with large eyes circling in their sockets, circling like planets loosening from gravity, the cows stamped nervously. Their breath streamed over the fields like white poison gas, so that now in summer what grows cannot nourish, and the swans are not swans anymore. They were not bought as hatchlings by the farmer to amuse his young wife, bored and vain as Emma Bovary. No, the swans are now what they were that time, fierce and disquieting. You were, for part of that night anyway, their golden egg. When you came to the edge of the pond to drink, to revive, they floated in to become your feathered altar. All night you had struggled up the hill and toward the edge of the gravel drive where you thought you might find your way, your stiletto broken from its lame sandal, your shorts soaked through, the halter knot tightening at the back of your neck. By then, of course, he had driven away. The arrogance of it, his turning on the blinker to ease back into traffic, to drive across town to his small brick house, to boil water in a saucepan for instant coffee, to keep an eye on the early morning news. The field is not the field, nor can it ever be again. Though as it changed, I slept on in a white house next door, which used to be a church. Perhaps you knew that. Perhaps you remembered coming here with your ardent aunties who swayed and swooned when the preacher led the hymns with his big baritone voice. Perhaps that's where you thought the gravel road led. But this is not church anymore, and I did not wake. I did not know about wakening. Another poem for you, Richard. Okay, this is called Nude Model, the poem that Richard was talking about. I audited a drawing class at my university. One of my friends taught. Nude model. The first time her tangerine kimono slips from her shoulders, I think she looks pretty good for her age, and I should know because she's about my age. But the dark and limber girls in drawing class suck in their gasps, and I find them tittering during their cigarette break on the steps outside. They are most concerned with her breasts, their droop and brown sag, the zig and zag of stretch marks, the way the nipples, pulled nipples glance down. But what do I have to throw back but the yellowish ooze of colostrum and the toothy joy of small things that find their own sniffling ways to the heart? Their smooth, bland faces tell me not to bother. I know this would be nothing to them but the moth eaten in rag when compared to the way their boyfriend's wet mouths slip up on them in the middle of night. When, for critique, our drawings go up on the wall, I see the girls have chosen to draw the soft folds of her orange robe, the philodendron's shiny leaves which trail behind the pose, the high, tight arch of her foot is the only part of her body they have considered as art. But I've returned again and again to her breasts. With slip of charcoal in my hand, I do study after study, fluid ink, I give in to paint pen, Conte, wild sweep of pink pastel. Each class I come back to her slandered curves and color her green and blue, sometimes rose, sometimes purple. I portray her as turned land and falling water, though I know even if it were possible for these fallow girls to imagine it, this is no garden they would choose to enter. The next poem I'm going to read is the one that I consider the heart of the book. It took me a long time to write it, and it was only after I began to pick up on all these things happening around our house. I always say that I'm the anti-global poet because I only write about it a mile around my house, which is very unfashionable now. And I admire gardeners' poems. They're so amazing. I thought, wow. And here I am stuck around my fish pond. Okay, so, but anyway, this is a poem about something that happened when I was a teenager, and it's always been in my mind. This poem is called Why I Mother You the Way I Do. That afternoon, I have to admit, there were no thoughts of you. I was in high school, making my way past the buses to a waiting car, a boy who would not be your father when the line of traffic stopped. The girls, sisters, classmates, had darted between buses and into the highway, trying to cross the field to their home. They both lay twisted in the road. My science teacher, Mr. DeSaro, took off his suit coat and laid it over Susan's face. He was crying because he only had one coat. By the time they let us pass, Eve had been covered with a white sheet. The ambulances had come. Red lights flashed, but their mother was still pushing her silver cart through the grocery. The sheriff was walking up behind her. As she reached for a gallon of milk, he moved to touch her arm. And then the last poem is a long poem, so settle back. It's actually the first poem, so Gardner, I'm going backwards too here. I laughingly call this the movie trailer for my book, because it has a lot of images. They're sort of stitched together. It's a collage poem, and it's called Overture. And what I tried to do in this poem was sort of put some images out that I went back later on and fleshed out. And so I usually read it last at readings, even though it comes first in the book, and because I think it works better for an audience, but I think you'll be able to see what the shape of the book is from that. So here we go. Overture. And it has an epigraph, but it's by me. I do this weird thing. I don't know why I do this, but I like to write my own epigraphs, which makes no sense. I don't attribute them, but still. This is called, O Come See What Has Been Planted. How Will One Woman Harvest This Night Dark Seed? By Kathleen Driscoll. No, I'm just kidding. Once, through the chalky bones of sycamores, the sheriff and the man, the father, looked down upon the hull of an overturned canoe knocking against the shore. In the swollen current, rotting apples wash by, their families holding fast within their bruised hearts. I remember that, and I remember, too, how it was raining the day we sat in the school buses, the silver windows and their glassy bubbles, and the way we were tossed forward, and we laughed until the sirens commenced. Murmurs rose. The children were asking, what's happened up there ahead in the road in front of the school? But we were so young then, it only took a week or two for the sounds of brakes and sirens to draw away. In an art class, we returned to replicating our masked selves and chalk portraits, faces of children who seemed to have forgotten what they'd seen in the road. It was as if nothing had happened until the man who came to install our carpet. So familiar, I thought, as I picked up book bags, shoes, and coats. Oh, of course. I'd gone to school with him. We laughed, finally recognizing that. Did we know anything then? Remember Mr. Blackburn, Mrs. Klein? I realized I had just thought of his brother, having read in the newspaper his name with the priests, but I knew enough to tamp that back down. Our children as old as the two dead girls, and we as old as the bus driver whose wipers swished and swished, but God help him, he could not see. Who could see that? And I recall other breaks and tire skidding and running, and I remember running through the snow, how it crunched beneath my feet and how my chest went, huh, huh, huh. How a body lay beneath the front tire. A young woman, all elbows and hands, danced awkwardly in the road. She screamed while a red envelope scuttled across the road, and I turned back to call 911 and ran toward the bland pink faces like cabbage roses pressed against cold glass. What did I say? I knelt down deliberately. Miss Hallahan's been hit. Help Mommy. Stay here. Stay. I yelled, pitching back the small words as I ran off again, and then I saw her shoe in our yard, and shoes spin through air, and apples bob, and canoes knock hard, and red envelopes flutter like red birds aflight. She'd come across the road to fetch her mail, and in her mail, a valentine. And I remember tucking the blanket around her and thinking, oh, Regina, you're already dead, aren't you? Though I began to chant, it's okay, it's okay. I opened up the words, cracked them open, and watched their green puffs float up. Words are like little spirits that way. And I remember blood splattered like seed across snow, and how without notice it melted away and washed down the road. And I remember the pressed faces of my children stained against the glass. If I must recall that our home is a church, then I must also remember that our lawn is its graveyard. So, the vet called it a tumor, and the old dog was carried home. Blankets came down from the hall closet to make a nest where our children slept with him one last night. Grief settled into the bones of Wyatt and Quinn. And when the dog was carried back out and put into the car, their bodies became houses they did not think they could live within. And my great-grandfather was driven from his house, and once at the railroad bridge, they found his plow horse tied to the trestle, and they found my great-grandfather's trousers, then a shirt folded, his socks pulled into each other, shoes faced and pointed as if in a soldier's closet. Then, 2 days later, his body bumping against the Kentucky shore. The skiff rocked as the men stood to gaff him out of the cold water. And once, a detective showed me a photograph. You know him? I recognized my neighbor, but took a moment to consider my answer. What would come if I said yes? If I said no? A girl had crawled across our lawn and up our neighbor's gravel drive, where all night she bled inside the gold egg of their vintage Cadillac. And once, in a room with periwinkle walls, the heavy matelasse spread collapsed to the floor, which was maple yellow and gleamed. And once, traffic flowed lightly below. I remember it was Sunday, and a sheer white curtain blew into the room. I could see the edge of my suitcase in the closet. And once, a bride's veil flew across the farmland of blue grass. And once, a bride sat beside a pool, and a black champagne bottle floated in its currents. And once, someone said, "Shh, don't you move." And once, my neighbor was resurrected from rehab and returned home wearing a stainless steel halo. But she didn't know I had saved her life, nor that I was her neighbor. And in a storm, she stood outside our house in a dark skirt that blew from side to side like a church bell. She looked up toward the luminous red lantern of my son's window, and I remember opening the door, and I called, "Regina, are you all right?" She didn't answer, drifted back home. And finally, I went upstairs and slept on the floor of my son's bedroom, where I heard my daughter wandering, sleepwalking through the halls. She moved like a child who knew things, and I knew I had walked the same way. And so I watched her and wondered who had told her these things, and when had I not been around? When? When I was her age, I lay on the flower davenport at my grandmother's home, and she told me things no child should know. But still, I wanted to know. Women were beaten so that their faces held the purple blooms of late roses. Men drank themselves to tears so that they were not men to the women who lived with them. Aunties drank lye then, and it was all about shame, as it always is, but also about living story. I recall that now, and I recall everything, for what do we have but the past to parent us? It has been told, because this yellow morning, my little daughter shook me awake and asked me to write a poem for her. "What shall I call it?" I asked, raising on my elbows. She put her finger on her lips and looked to the ceiling. A moment later, she said, "I think you should call it The Rain Comes Wild." And then the rain began to peck and pock. Thank you.